I should have to comment that as far as religion is concerned, human beings can be divided into three types. First, there are those who still genuinely believe their religious doctrines, whatever they may be. For these people, the symbols and doctrines click so satisfyingly with what they feel deep inside themselves that serious doubts have no chance to sneak in. This happens when the views of consciousness and the unconscious background are in relative harmony. People of this sort can afford to look at new psychological discoveries and facts without prejudice and need not fear that they may be caused to lose their faith. Even if their dreams should bring up some relatively unorthodox details, these can be integrated into their general view. The second type consists of those people who have completely lost their faith and have replaced it with purely conscious, rational opinions. For these people, depth psychology simply means an introduction into newly discovered areas of the psyche, and it should cause no trouble when they embark on the new adventure and investigate their dreams to test the truth of them. Then there is a third group of people who, in one part of themselves, probably the head, no longer believe in their religious traditions, whereas in some other part they still do believe. The French philosopher Voltaire is an illustration of this. He violently attacked the Catholic Church with rational argument, écraser l'infâme. But on his deathbed, according to some reports, he begged for extreme unction. Whether this is true or not, his head was certainly unreligious, whereas his feelings and emotions seem still to have been orthodox. Such people remind one of a person getting stuck in the automatic doors of a bus. He can neither get out into free space nor re-enter the bus. Of course, the dreams of such persons could probably help them out of their dilemma, but such people frequently have trouble turning toward the unconscious because they themselves do not know what they think and want. To take the unconscious seriously is ultimately a matter of personal courage and integrity. The complicated situation of those who are caught in a no-man's land between the two states of mind is partly created by the fact that all official religious doctrines actually belong to the collective consciousness, what Freud called the superego. But once, long ago, they sprang from the unconscious. This is a point that many historians of religion and theologians challenge. They choose to assume that there was once some sort of revelation. I have searched for many years for concrete evidence for the Jungian hypothesis about this problem, but it has been difficult to find because most rituals are so old that one cannot trace their origin. The following example, however, seems to me to offer a most important clue. Black Elk, a medicine man of the Oglala Sioux, who died not long ago, tells us in his autobiography, Black Elk Speaks, that when he was 9 years old, he became seriously ill, and during a sort of coma, had a tremendous vision. He saw four groups of beautiful horses coming from the four corners of the world, and then, seated within a cloud, he saw the six grandfathers, the ancestral spirits of his tribe, the grandfathers of the whole world. They gave him six healing symbols for his people and showed him new ways of life. But when he was 16 years old, he suddenly developed a terrible phobia whenever a thunderstorm was approaching because he heard thunder beings calling to him to make haste. It reminded him of the thundering noise made by the approaching horses in his vision. An old medicine man explained to him that his fear came from the fact that he was keeping his vision to himself and said that he must tell it to his tribe. He did so, and later he and his people acted out the vision in a ritual using real horses. Not merely Black Elk himself, but many other members of his tribe felt infinitely better after this play. Some were even cured of their diseases. Black Elk said, "Even the horses seemed to be healthier and happier after the dance." The ritual was not repeated because the tribe was dead soon afterward. But here is a different case in which a ritual still survives. Several Eskimo tribes living near the Colville River in Alaska explain the origin of their eagle festival in the following way. A young hunter shot dead a very unusual eagle and was so impressed by the beauty of the dead bird that he stuffed and made a fetish of him, honoring him by sacrifices. One day, when the hunter had traveled far inland during his hunting, two animal men suddenly appeared in the role of messengers and led him to the land of the eagles. There he heard a dark drumming noise, and the messengers explained that this was the heartbeat of the dead eagle's mother. Then the eagle spirit appeared to the hunter as a woman clothed in black. She asked him to initiate an eagle festival among his people to honor her dead son. After the eagle people had shown him how to do this, he suddenly found himself, exhausted, back in the place where he had met the messengers. Returning home, he taught his people how to perform the Great Eagle Festival, as they have done faithfully ever since. From such examples, we see how a ritual or religious custom can spring directly from an unconscious revelation experienced by a single individual. Out of such beginnings, people living in cultural groups develop their various religious activities with their enormous influence on the entire life of the society. During a long process of evolution, the original material is shaped and reshaped by words and actions, is beautified, and acquires increasingly definite forms. This crystallizing process, however, has a great disadvantage. More and more people have no personal knowledge of the original experience and can only believe what their elders and teachers tell them about it. They no longer know that such happenings are real, and they are, of course, ignorant about how one feels during the experience. In their present forms, worked over and exceedingly aged, such religious traditions often resist further creative alterations by the unconscious. Theologians sometimes even defend these true religious symbols and symbolic doctrines against the discovery of a religious function in the unconscious psyche, forgetting that the values they fight for owe their existence to that very same function. Without a human psyche to receive divine inspirations and utter them in words or shape them in art, no religious symbol has ever come into the reality of our human life. We need only think of the prophets and the evangelists. If someone objects that there is a religious reality in itself, independent of the human psyche, I can only answer such a person with this question. Who says this, if not a human psyche? No matter what we assert, we can never get away from the existence of the psyche, for we are contained within it, and it is the only means by which we can grasp reality. Thus, the modern discovery of the unconscious shuts one door forever. It definitely excludes the illusory idea, so favored by some individuals, that a man can know spiritual reality in itself. In modern physics, too, a door has been closed by Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy, shutting out the delusion that we can comprehend an absolute physical reality. The discovery of the unconscious, however, compensates for the loss of these beloved illusions by opening before us an immense and unexplored new field of realizations within which objective scientific investigation combines in a strange new way with personal ethical adventure. But, as I said at the outset, it is practically impossible to impart the whole reality of one's experience in the new field. Much is unique and can be only partially communicated by language. Here, too, a door is shut against the illusion that one can completely understand another person and tell him what is right for him. Once again, however, one can find a compensation for this in the new realm of experience by the discovery of the social function of the self, which works in a hidden way to unite separate individuals who belong together. Intellectual chit-chat is thus replaced by meaningful events that occur in the reality of the psyche. Hence, for the individual to enter seriously into the process of individuation in the way that has been outlined means a completely new and different orientation toward life. For scientists, it also means a new and different scientific approach to outer facts. How this will work out in the field of human knowledge and in the social life of human beings cannot be predicted. But to me, it seems certain that Jung's discovery of the process of individuation is a fact that future generations will have to take into account if they want to avoid drifting into a stagnant or even regressive outlook. Photo captions. The Rose Window of the Cathedral of Notre Dame, Paris. Below, a meander, a decoration in a 7th century manuscript. Individual dreams seem as strange and fragmented as the detail above from the decoration, but over a lifetime's dreaming, a meandering pattern appears, revealing the process of psychic growth. The psyche can be compared to a sphere with a bright field, A, on its surface, representing consciousness. The ego is the field center. Only if I know a thing is it conscious. The self is at once the nucleus and the whole sphere, B. Its internal regulating processes produce dreams. An earth altar beneath a tree, in a 19th century Chinese painting. Such round or square structures usually symbolize the self, to which the ego must submit to fulfill the process of individuation. A child, adapting to the outside world, receives many psychological shocks. Far left, the fearful first day at school. Center, the surprise and pain resulting from an attack by another child. Left, the grief and bewilderment of the first experience of death. As in effect a protection from such shocks, the child may dream or draw a circular, quadrangular, nuclear motif above that symbolizes the all-important center of the psyche. Far left, a woodcut from a 17th century alchemical manuscript depicts a king who has fallen ill, a common symbolic image of the emptiness and boredom in the consciousness that can mark the initial stage of the individuation process. Left, from the 1960 Italian film La Dolce Vita, another image of this psychological state. Guests explore the rundown interior of a decayed aristocrat's castle. Right, a painting by the modern Swiss artist Paul Klee entitled Fairy Tale. It illustrates a tale of a young man who sought and found the bluebird of happiness, and so could marry a princess. In many fairy tales, such a talisman is necessary to cure illness or misfortune, symbols of our feelings of emptiness and futility. Three examples of a collective infection that can weld people into an irrational mob, and to which the shadow, the dark side of the ego personality, is vulnerable. Left, a scene from a 1961 Polish film concerning 17th century French nuns who were possessed by the devil. Right, a drawing by Bruegel depicts the affliction, largely psychosomatic, called St. Vitus's Dance, which was widespread in the Middle Ages. Far right, the fiery cross emblem of the Ku Klux Klan, the white supremacy secret society of America's South, whose racial intolerance has often led to acts of mob violence. Left, Anxious Journey, by the modern Italian artist De Chirico. The title and gloomy passages of the painting express the nature of the first contact with the unconscious when the individuation process begins. The unconscious is often symbolized by corridors, labyrinths, or mazes. Right, on a papyrus, about 1400 BC, the seven doors of the Egyptian underworld, itself seen as a maze. Below, drawings of three mazes, left to right, a Finnish stone maze, Bronze Age, a 19th century British turf maze, and a maze in tiles on the floor of Chartres Cathedral. It could be walked as a symbolic pilgrimage to the Holy Land. Rather than face our defects as revealed by the shadow, we project them onto others, for instance, onto our political enemies. Above left, a poster made for a parade in communist China shows America as an evil serpent bearing Nazi swastikas killed by a Chinese hand. Left, Hitler during a speech. For over 5 years, this man has been chasing around Europe like a madman in search of something he could set on fire. Unfortunately, he again and again finds hirelings who open the gates of their country to this international incendiary. The quotation is Hitler's description of Churchill. Projections also flourish in malicious gossip. Right, from the British television series Coronation Street. Above, the wild white stallion from the 1953 French film Crin Blanc. Wild horses often symbolize the uncontrollable instinctive drives that can erupt from the unconscious, and that many people try to repress. In the film, the horse and a boy form a strong attachment, though the horse still runs wild with his herd. But local horsemen set out to capture the wild horses. The stallion and his boy rider are pursued for miles. Finally, they are cornered on the seashore. Rather than submit to capture, the boy and the horse plunge into the sea to be swept away. Symbolically, the story's end seems to represent an escape into the unconscious, the sea, as a way to avoid facing reality in the outside world. The shadow can be said to have two aspects, one dangerous, the other valuable. The painting of the Hindu god Vishnu, far left, images such a duality. Usually considered a benevolent god, Vishnu here appears in a demonic aspect, tearing a man apart. Left, from a Japanese temple, A.D. 759. A sculpture of Buddha also expresses duality. The god's many arms hold symbols of both good and evil. Right, the doubt-stricken Martin Luther, portrayed by Albert Finney in the 1961 play Luther by Britain's John Osborne. Luther was never sure whether his break from the church was inspired by God or arose from his own pride and obstinacy, in symbolic terms, the evil side of his shadow. The anima, the female element in a male psyche, is often personified as a witch or a priestess, women who have links with forces of darkness and the spirit world, that is, the unconscious. Left, a sorceress with imps and demons, in a 17th century engraving. Below, a shaman of a Siberian tribe who is a man dressed as a woman, because women are thought to be more able to contact spirits. Above, a woman spiritualist or medium, from the 1951 film The Medium, based on an opera by Giancarlo Menotti. The majority of modern mediums are probably women. The belief is still widespread that women are more receptive than men to the irrational. The anima, like the shadow, has two aspects, benevolent and malefic, or negative. Left, a scene from Orphée, a film version by Cocteau of the Orpheus myth. The woman can be seen as a lethal anima, for she has led Orpheus, being carried by dark underworld figures, to his doom. Also malevolent are the Lorelei of Teutonic myth, below, in a 19th century drawing, water spirits whose singing lures men to their death. Below right, a parallel from Slavonic myth, the Rusalka. These beings were thought to be spirits of drowned girls who bewitch and drown passing men. Above, four scenes from the 1930 German film The Blue Angel, which concerns a straight-laced professor's infatuation with a cabaret singer, clearly a negative anima figure. The girl uses her charm to degrade the professor, even making him a buffoon in her cabaret act. Right. A drawing of Salome with the head of John the Baptist, whom she had killed to prove